'Tis the season for close contact with people coughing and sneezing their way through the holidays. Now's the time to make sure your immune system is as strong as it can be. You've heard me talk about how I've used Empower to supercharge my immune system. Now my friends at The Harmony Company have introduced the ultimate in holiday season protection, Empower Plus. This improved formula combines AHCC, one of the most powerful mushroom extracts, with fermented wheat germ extract, super concentrate, enhancing your immune system like never before. With more than 150 combined published research reports, Empower Plus will quickly give your immune system the super boost you need. Protect your good health with Empower Plus. For more information and to order, go to theharmonycompany.com. That's theharmonycompany.com or call 800-422-5518. 800-422-5518. Use coupon code HOFFMAN10 at checkout and get a 10% discount and free shipping. That's theharmonycompany.com for the new Empower Plus. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. As we approach the Christmas season, we're in the Christmas season, and curiously enough, usually we get kind of a warm-up act, which is Hanukkah, which generally precedes Christmas, but a very interesting concordance. Its first day is on the first day of Christmas. So, due to the...
Wow.
Due to the vicissitudes of the lunar calendar, it's kind of a weird calendar, traditional Jewish calendar, it is pretty late this year, so everybody's going to celebrate around the same time. It's kind of cool. And things are frenetic here in Manhattan. I know you reside in Queens, where, things may be a little quieter, but man, the streets are crowded with tourists, shoppers.
It's frenetic.
You could barely get down Fifth Avenue. It's like sidewalks are packed. People are looking at the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. And it is...
And loads of tourists.
Lots
of tourists.
Yeah.
So you walk up and down Fifth Avenue, you hear a multitude of languages.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. New York ain't dead yet. Okay.
Nope.
And there's kind of a nice buzz, optimistic spirit in the air. Okay. We will get to questions. Questions come via questions@drhoffman.net. And we have several great questions in our mailbox that we're going to address momentarily. But before we do that, I have a question for you, Layla.
Mm-hmm.
If you were given a choice of having greater longevity, but with a poorer health span, say, guarantee you're going to live to be 100, but the last 20 years of your life would be mired in misery with a disabling disease that requires constant medication, surgical intervention, etc. Or if you were guaranteed a more modest lifespan, say a lifespan to 80, but with a health span that is about 79 and a half years, and during the last few months you might experience a decline and then drop off at 80. Which option would you choose? Option A or option B? Door number one or door number two?
B.
B.
Absolutely B.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's an individual, I think that's an individual choice, but I actually think that the majority of people would pick that option. And so apropos of that, here's an interesting article. It's based on a World Health Organization study. Yeah, I know. We have some issues with the World Health Organization. Yeah, right.
Okay.
But they do research. Okay, at the very least, research. And they did an interesting study, and it's published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, this week. They looked at 183 countries across the world, spanning all the continents, and looking at both Western, highly developed countries, of course, including the United States, but including all of the Western European countries, and but also looked at sub-Saharan Africa and Asia, 183 countries. And they looked at two things. They looked at lifespan, and they looked at health span. Health span being the number of years that people live without disability and or illness. And what they found was quite interesting. On average, the health span of people, that is, the time between they started to experience the ravages of aging and disability before they died, was 9.3 years. Okay?
Neat.
Where do you think the United States rated among the 183 countries?
Oh, lowest on the list?
That is a good guess, and ding, 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 you're right. Okay. You were rewarded by your pessimism about the American health picture, because indeed...
I'm rewarded the facts about American health?
Yeah. Americans will live 12.4 years with disability and or illness. Get this, up from 10.9 years in 2000. So in our recent history, 24 years ago, we actually had a lower health span, which is good in this case. Or shall we say a greater health span, because we're talking about the years when you feel good.
Yes.
Before
versus
you die.
Lifespan.
Right.
Yeah.
So the years that Americans spent with disability and or illness was 12.4 years on average. So, you know, some comments on that. You know, one of the things that drives this, of course, is in certain countries, you kind of live fast and die young. You know, in Africa, in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, in parts of the lesser developed world, people do die young. They die of medical conditions that can be more easily addressed in more advanced countries. Okay?
Yeah.
So that is one of the reasons why, you know, people live to relatively healthy middle age, and then they get sick and die at the age of 58 or 61 in certain countries. Here in the United States, we have one of the world's most advanced healthcare systems, and we have life-saving therapies. And most expensive, but it ultimately not leading us to the highest levels of longevity, because we're vastly exceeded by such countries as Japan and Switzerland, where their longevity is many years longer than for the average American. But the problem being is that the take-home message here is that we've extended life at the expense of our health span. So what good is it to allow people to survive longer and linger, but suffer from really debilitating health problems that ultimately undermine the quality of their lives? And they also did an analysis here. They said, well, what's causing this gap for America? And it was mostly what are called non-communicable diseases. Okay?
Yes.
So we're not, you know, we're saving people with antibiotics. We're saving people with heroic therapies that prevent deaths. Mm-hmm. You know, they used to call pneumonia the old man's friend, you know, when you were kind of on fumes, the pneumonia bug would come along and dispatch you.
Take you out.
Take you out, right? No longer, because we now can kill some of the most resistant bacteria, and that enables people to survive, but at the cost of potentially a health span. So anyways, this is the context into which we enter 2025. There's going to be a big debate about the direction that healthcare is taking. There's a lot of factors that are promoting that. I think, you know, unfortunately, this poor guy, the CEO, was shot down in cold blood in Manhattan in a terrible assassination. On the other hand, this is going to, we've highlighted the role that some of these insurers play in denying care. I just read a really scathing article in the New Yorker about the role that private equity plays in terms of buying up hospitals and medical practices and how they try to squeeze.
It's all about the bottom line.
They try to squeeze all the profit out of these things. At the expense of quality of care. But at the same time, we can't you know, can't fault the insurance companies for cost containment because, look, okay, let's get socialized medicine like they have in England. Well, who's going to be the bad guy? It's going to be the government net rationing care, or similarly in Canada, where you have to wait long time sometimes to get an appointment with a specialist or to get a surgery that ordinarily you could schedule.
You have to wait 6 months for the hip replacement.
Yeah.
Which so you get to be disabled until then. Yeah.
So, you know, somehow we have to figure out a balance between aggressive care. And I'm looking at some of the drugs. The costs of some of these drugs are astronomical. I just looked at a drug that is for men with prostate cancer that's failed all other types of therapy, the prostate cancer that is metastatic to, you know, the bone and through all parts of the body. And it has been approved. It costs $250,000 for 6 treatments. It is also associated with costs for diagnostic tests associated with its use so that it can be used properly and safely. And the statistics show that it increases average survival from 11 months to 14 months. Okay? Now, five months may be very important for a person. I'm not going to deny that. And this was approved on the basis that it could extend life. But we're going to have to make some really, really tough decisions about the direction we want our healthcare system to take. Because it's unsustainable right now. 14% of our gross national product is spent on healthcare. That's not sustainable.
Yeah. Well, things need to change. Oh my. Yeah. And people are being bankrupted or they're having to make terrible choices.
Yes.
Or people, tragically, some people take it into their own hands and decide suicide. But you know what? Your spouse doesn't get the life insurance that way, do they? I mean, there are terrible things that people are actually thinking about when faced with a terrible situation like that, a terrible decision like that. It's tragic.
Yep. Well, anyway, so this is...
I'm gloomy. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this is the context for... you know, this discussion that's going to be ongoing, you know, well beyond next year. But, you know, highlighting it is going to be the new administration with a bunch of people who have kind of new ideas about the shape that our healthcare system should take. And I wrote about it in the past 3 newsletter articles. I sort of broke down some of the different candidates. You know, you've got, different people like Mehmet Oz, you've got RFK Jr., you've got Jay Bhattacharya. Exactly. And so hopefully we'll figure out a way out of this mess.
Yes. Yes. And many heads like those mentioned are, I think, are great. I feel very encouraged and I look forward to 2025.
Yeah, and we're part of the initiative to emphasize the lifestyle changes that will help people avert preventable chronic diseases, which undermine not just lifespan, but health span, which make people miserable.
Yeah. It's, as you said, it's the non-communicable diseases that are the problem.
Yep.
Or chronic diseases,
Wow.
Okay, so let's take a break.
Yes.
And hear from one of our sponsors?
Indeed. Good idea. Let's listen up. Here it goes. You're listening to Intelligent Medicine, a resource to help you take control of your health. We offer a balanced, objective analysis of all your health, wellness, and aging options, both conventional and alternative. Now you can take your engagement to the next level by joining Fullscript. Fullscript is my online dispensing platform that only offers curated, professional-grade supplement brands that I know and trust. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com for more information and to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant and offers world-class support. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals, including my custom targeted protocols that combine the products I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. It's all at DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They are what make intelligent medicine a continuing resource to you. Best of all, free at no charge through their generous underwriting. And now back to our questions. Questions come to questions@drhoffman.net. Go ahead.
We've got an email from Sue. For those who have an autoimmune disease like lupus, Sjogren's, rheumatoid arthritis, is there a danger in taking a supplement which enhances immunity? For example, like several chiolic aged garlic supplements, as well as some others, boast that they include immune support. So is it yay or nay for somebody with an autoimmune condition?
I actually posed this question to a recent guest who was talking to us about AHCC, one of our sponsors, Harmony Company. And so he actually gave a very nuanced answer on that. And I have always said that the immune system is much more complicated than a dimmer switch. You know, a dimmer switch, you know, dim the lights, you turn it, you know, goes down. And when you turn it up, the lights go on. The immune system is not just two-dimensional. If you could do sort of a thought experiment, it's maybe 100-dimensional. There's a lot of dimensions to the immune system. Some things that if you increase them, they actually help to tamp down an out-of-control immune system. So they're actually, there are checks and balances within the immune system. Mm-hmm. One way to look at that, you know, I recently went to a wonderful Christmas concert at the Philharmonic here in New York, and I thought of this analogy to the immune system. You know, all the different parts of the orchestra are perfectly in balance. And when you take a supplement that, quote, enhances the immune system, it has kind of an adaptogenic effect. And that's what AHCC does. It does not cause the immune system to go into overdrive. The idea in autoimmunity is the body in a hyper immune response undertakes an exuberant attack on your own body parts instead of on foreign invader. So this is, essentially the analogy is the bank robber comes to the bank guards start shooting, they hit the bank robber, but they also have some unintended victims among the customers, right? This is collateral damage. And that's a little bit what happens when the immune system goes awry with these conditions. It starts to turn on in an effort to attack an invader. That invader may be a virus. It may be, you know, chemical exposure. It may be something, you know, could be something from the microbiome, something that the immune system perceives as hostile, and it goes into overdrive. Okay. Mm-hmm. And things like AHCC and other immune-regulating supplements generally have an adaptogenic effect. Now, this issue came up around COVID because COVID has an aspect to it where people generally recover, but the sickest people with COVID seem to go into what is called cytokine storm, which means that the virus triggered an over-exuberant response and the whole immune system went into meltdown. And so among the natural things that are used, we have elderberry, for example, which has been found to be helpful for the flu. So by analogy, it was suggested for COVID. And there were a lot of arguments back and forth about whether elderberry should be employed for COVID because of its potential to overstimulate the immune system. And the suggestion by some clinicians was, use elderberry in the early phases of that, but if it appears you're going into cytokine storm, you could stop, you know, probably should
stop taking it.
Give it a rest, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that ever got really properly researched. I'm not sure if that's been, it's theoretically a possibility, but things that support.
Did this come?
Go ahead. I just was going to give you an example. Vitamin D has an effect on the immune system. And what it does is it both combats infections. In the absence of vitamin D, you have less resistance to infections because it actually helps with something called cathepsin, which is something that the white blood cells use to fight bacterial infections. Okay. But it also has a beneficial effect in autoimmunity. So that's an example of something which has kind of a two-pronged effect. It curbs autoimmunity.
It's an immune modulator.
Thank you.
It's a modulator more than anything, vitamin D. It's like Goldilocks for the immune system. It's just right. Right? It's that kind of an effect rather than... Did the whole thing of cytokine storm start with the 1918 Spanish flu when everybody was taking a lot of aspirin, or the actual dosage of aspirin was higher at that time or something like that, which could have created that cytokine storm?
That's interesting. That's one theory. You know, another theory, of course, is they didn't have antibiotics then, but it was the type of virus that actually killed younger people and people with robust immune systems. It was less likely to kill you if you were older and debilitated, which is different from COVID, which primarily victimized people who had risk factors.
Comorbidity,
so-called. I think that we need to do more research on the effect of each and every supplement in the context of an autoimmune condition. I agree that it's a bit of a gray area, but I don't think that per se the fact that they, quote, boost the immune system or enhance the immune system precludes their use in an autoimmune condition.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. I'm trying to think of a case study or something over the years of our patients with autoimmunity. I don't recall anyone having a problem with taking some extra vitamin C or zinc for a cold, for example.
Yep.
During cold and flu season or something like that, or a probiotic.
Right. But, you know, then we have to look at mushrooms. We have to look at things like cordyceps. We have to look at HCC. I actually think that things like that have a more regulatory effect rather than a, you know, light switch kind of effect.
Right. Doesn't come in and overpower. Right.
Yep.
Okay. Or super boost.
Help.
Sue, thank you for this very thoughtful question. Okay. Yeah. And I just want to mention for anybody with an autoimmune condition, you have to make changes in their diet. There are diet changes to be made so that hopefully you can make it cease and desist would be the objective, right? But there are things to do, and it's beneficial to have a consult with somebody who's qualified in doing that. Okay. Let's see here. We have a question from Barbara about DCIS or, quote, early breast cancer, end quote. Dear Dr. H and Layla, love your show. I've been listening forever. Thank you for all that you do. My question is regarding DCIS. I've been diagnosed with DCIS twice in 6 years. I only chose a lumpectomy. I refused radiation and tamoxifen or other estrogen-depleting medicines as the side effects I read about were awful, and I am postmenopausal. I understand there's new discussion on the overtreatment of these lesions or so-called tumors. I've been also trying to exercise more, improve my diet. Also, I feel like I've received far too many mammograms, and I'm interested in newer forms of screening. Unfortunately, insurance won't pay for an ultrasound unless you get a mammogram first. And what about a scan like a QT scan? Sorry, this is a subject maybe for a whole other show, but I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, it is indeed a subject for a whole other show because there is some news on DCIS. And ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, is actually not cancer. It is a precursor of invasive breast cancer. It's carcinoma, well, cancer, but in situ, which means that it is very localized, okay? And so there's a whole controversy whether it should even be called cancer, but traditionally the treatment for DCIS has been pretty aggressive. First, you get a lumpectomy.
Chemotherapy and radiation.
Not necessarily.
Oh my God.
Not necessarily chemo. Not necessarily chemo, but possibly radiation. The problem with DCIS has been that a local site of DCIS might be predictive of DCIS everywhere in the breasts. And so some women with DCIS they've even elected for prophylactic mastectomy. They've said, look, I just don't want all these tests. I don't want the anxiety. Cancer is forming in my breast.
They don't want all the surveillance.
And I don't care anymore. Just whack them off, you know, to put it bluntly. Okay. And so, but there's also been some controversy about, do you need to go full court press on it? And there's a new study. A study just came out this month. It's the COMET trial, COMET, which evaluated the safety of not just omitting radiation and hormonal therapy, because hormonal therapy is that thing that, like a blocker, you know, you take an estrogen blocker.
Yes, tamoxifen.
Yeah. Right? Rivadex, something like that. And so this basically is now putting DCIS into the category of prostate cancer, where we do active surveillance, active holistic surveillance, hopefully with, you know, lifestyle modification, you know, healthy diet, the use of certain cancer preventive supplements. But basically you monitor it. So they actually looked at this. They looked at women age 40 or older, and they were randomized to surgery with or without X-ray therapy or endocrine therapy. So that some of them didn't have the surgery, but they had some endocrine therapy or they had some radiation therapy. But the others did get the surgery plus or minus X-ray therapy or endocrine therapy. And this is what they found. At 2 years of follow-up, the rate of invasive cancer development did not differ between the groups. Okay? So, now, but the catch is that sometimes a significant percentage of time when they do surgery on what appears to be DCIS, because you don't know from an imaging study, you don't know from mammogram what it's going to be. You to diagnose DCIS, you've gotten a one of those biopsies via a syringe. You know, you've got like a needle biopsy. And so that sample will show that there's DCIS. That's what the pathology reading is. But until you do the surgery, you don't know if there's some, maybe there is some hidden full-blown cancer. Okay. So they found that sometimes when they did that surgery, they actually found that it was full-blown cancer. But most of the time they found that it was what appeared to be on the needle biopsy, which is DCIS. And so now some of the women who had DCIS, ultimately they're going to need to have surgery or more aggressive treatment for the DCIS because it'll progress. But that's kind of the way they now deal with prostate cancer. They watch it. In some men who have low-grade prostate cancer, a low cancer burden, very localized. And it, you know, from our standpoint, we love to work with those types of men because they change their diets, they take anti-cancer supplements, they up their exercise, which is known to be beneficial, and they often do very well. They don't need subsequent surgery. One of the nice things about prostate cancer, it's easier to monitor. We simply need to look at the PSA. The problem with breast cancer is we don't have a PSA for the breast. That would be nice because, you know, if you see a guy who's doing watchful waiting and their PSA is like, okay, we started at 2, then it's 3, then it's 5, then it's 7, then it's 9. Uh-oh. Okay, we need to do something here, you know. With the breast, we don't have that type of test. We hope to develop that type of test so that women don't get bombarded with mammograms. But still, it's the gold standard for following up. And unfortunately, it does come with a higher risk of irradiating the breast tissue, which we know is not great, and carries with it a small but significant risk of causing mutations in the cells and causing, and in fact, triggering cancer, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And Barbara says she feels that she's received far too many mammograms and is interested in other types of, you know, it is a shame because ultrasound is less invasive. Why don't they do more of that instead of mammogram?
Well, the other thing they do is when they're really concerned about following up on cancer, they'll look at MRIs, but MRIs are expensive and probably they're going to stipulate, you know, the insurance will say, oh, first you need to get a mammogram. And if the mammogram is unclear, then you're entitled to an MRI. Ultrasounds are cheap. Ultrasounds are cheap, but there's no radiation. There's no radiation with MRIs either. So it'd be great if MRIs were so convenient.
If they were the norm, if they were convenient,
And, but at least ultrasounds.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe because ultrasound takes a little more time.
Yeah, but ultrasound is standalone. Ultrasound is not as accurate in detecting cancer as mammogram. The mammogram first will look at something, and then additional information can be obtained from the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And now they're using AI as a way to improve on the predictive value of mammograms and ultrasound. So we get a little more precision rather than just like a radiologist's opinion as to how it looks.
Yeah. Well, so, okay.
It's called 3D mammography, you know, it's like, and it's your computer assisted AI, machine learning, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of the latest, greatest imaging that offers more precision.
Yeah. A big issue about DCIS is the over-treatment of it.
Yeah.
And the other problem with mammogram is so many false positives, and that creates a lot of anxiety. And then that's more setting up for more invasive treatment and so forth. And
make another point on this is what they found pretty conclusively is if you are like, you know, a woman who's 82 and they discover you have DCIS, you pretty much shouldn't get treatment for that because the cancer that's going to kill you is going to kill you at 111. You know, could be very slow developing cancer, even if it does develop into cancer. And you're more likely to die of natural causes or other causes before then. But then the question arises is, well, then why bother to do mammograms routinely on women who don't have cancer when they're 82? You know, is there a certain point where you kind of just say, hey, it's not going to make a difference anyway?
Yeah. Isn't there a cutoff age?
No.
I thought it was 70-something.
There isn't.
For routine recommendations, yes. But, you know, women, you know, dutifully show up and, you know, perhaps they've had some slight abnormality before, or they have a family history, or they're very concerned.
Or they have dense breasts.
Okay.
Or, you know, any health conference I've been to recently says we're going to live to 120. So, you know, you don't want to be taken down at 111 if you're 82.
Be careful what you wish for is all I have to say.
I'm 60. That means I'm middle-aged.
Right. But have you seen Jimmy Carter lately? He's 101.
My goodness, yeah.
Not in the something? Greatest shape. Not in the greatest shape.
Right.
But he's alive. He's alive.
It's alive. Yeah.
Barbara, thank you for your very thoughtful question.
Okay.
All right. Good point at which to flip over to side two, because that's all that this LP can accommodate. So we're going to give us a preview of what we're going to talk about, part two.
Adam is asking, what does standardization in a supplement mean?
Okay. Great. Great question. We appreciate your questions. You can send questions to questions@drhoffman.net. But aren't these questions great? I mean, really,
they are
triggering wonderful conversations. And I just want to commend our listeners for how astute you are at teeing up important issues for us to discuss. Mm-hmm. This is a lot of fun because you never know what we're going to talk about on our weekly Q&A with Layla. Okay, so we'll proceed to part two. Stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla.